Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone, coming to you live from Macquarie University, and I'm here today with Noah Cohen, who is a lecturer in American Culture Studies at Washington University in St. Louis, and he's also the author of a really fascinating book that I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to read. The title of the book is We Average Unbeautiful Watchers, Fan Narratives and the Reading of American Sport. It's out from University of Nebraska Press in 2019. Thank you very much, Noah, for joining us.
Thank you, Keith. A pleasure to be with you.
I have to start out by asking you how you developed such a fascinating project.
Well, like a lot of academic projects, it's sort of a combination of the personal and professional coming together. I think maybe the personal piece is a little more out front than it is for some academics, but I'm sure a few of your listeners will be surprised to hear that sports were a very important part of my life as a young person. Was never really that gifted of an athlete, so fandom was my primary connection to sports. Eventually ended up going to college and majoring in English. Thought I was going to do sports broadcasting, actually. That was my goal. But I had to major in something. They didn't have a journalism school, so I majored in English. And then after college, I worked in sports for several years and kind of decided that I was not that interested in the business of sports and more interested in sort of thinking about sports on critical terms, that some of those undergraduate professors had influenced me more than I had really realized, and I wasn't willing to just sort of sit back and root for teams or root for leagues or, you know, whoever it was. I was more invested in thinking about why fandom mattered to me, why it mattered to the people around me, why the capital involved was so much in increasing amounts throughout my life. So I went back to grad school. I went to an English PhD program, and I wasn't sure whether this sports interest was gonna be able to connect with my studies. But I found that it was able to. I found an advisor who didn't think I was crazy to want to think about sports and sports fandom on narrative terms, and that got me through grad school. I really powered me through. Some of my cohort mates picked topics that I think they were a little less enamored with, and had a little bit of a harder time, but I was motivated to work in this field and wrote a dissertation that I was really fortunate to have a press interested in it in Nebraska Press, and it became this book. So it was in some ways an unconventional path. In other ways, it was a pretty smooth one, and I'm really pleased that, you know, the book is here and out, and that I can share it with people.
It's kind of funny in some ways. I think you're right. Maybe in in your case, more than in other cases, you really are a little bit out in front of your own research, because one of the things your work does so well is to illustrate the way in which sport is a narrative. Although I think for our listeners who maybe are not always as up to date on discursive analysis or anything like that, maybe we should explain a little bit what you mean. So when you say sport is a narrative, what are you talking about? Why is sport a narrative? How can sport be a narrative? And is sport, as you say throughout your book, in fact, necessarily a narrative?
Yeah, so, you know, we all know that consuming sport involves stories on some level. When a journalist writes a recap of a sporting event, that's called a sports story, right? That much is obvious. But really, the argument that I'm trying to make is that sports are story based on a much more fundamental level, right? That the events themselves are stories. They may feature a live competition. They feature real athletes who are pushing their bodies to their limits. But those the fundamental building blocks of sports competitive construct don't change the fact that all the basic elements of narrative are there. There are characters, there's a plot. You know, every sporting event has a very clearly marked beginning, middle, and end. There's a sort of narrative climax, a denouement that comes after. So, I mean, all the pieces of stories are present. We just don't really want to see them that way often because of the liveness of sport, because of that competitive construct. But I think throughout the book and in different ways, I try to argue that actually seeing them as stories, understanding them as narratives, and thinking about ourselves, the fans, as readers of sport, when we watch a sporting event, when we consume sports content, can free us up to do a lot of really interesting things in the way that we consume sport. That there's a real potential there to destabilize some of the aspects of sports consumership that can be problematic or downright toxic at times. And that thinking of ourselves as readers has a lot of potential to sort of demystify or detoxify those elements of sports fandom.
Yeah. I mean, I in reading through it, I kept agreeing, you know, I kept writing down, yes, you know, I totally agree that thinking about the way in which we as fans are engaging with sports as a kind of narrative story that we read in different ways opens up new ways of viewing sports. And that's kind of, maybe that's what a lot of people in sports studies are doing anyway, without realizing it, right? We're critically engaging as readers with the, mm-hmm. with a type of narrative. I did wonder, throughout, and I guess just kind of as another definitional question, how you're looking at different types of fandom. So I wondered if you could unpack that term of fan that you use for us a little bit more. Everything from casual observer to fanatic. What is a fan in your interpretation?
Yeah, so I'm really invested in an understanding of fandom that is based on a spectrum that is pretty fluid, right? That you can be a fan even if you are the most casual observer. You can consider yourself a fan and have things that you are invested in that make you a fan, even if you're just a fan in that moment, right? And not a fan, you know, the next moment, all the way to, you know, the person who, you know, has the, you know, Minnesota Vikings tattoo and they dress in purple face paint every week, and their entire sort of attitude for that week is determined by whether the Vikings win or lose. That these are related types, not distinct species, right? That fandom is that spectrum. And in part, that's based on wanting to prevent a phenomenon that often happens in fandom, which is a kind of gatekeeping, right? And this happens in all kinds of fandom, not just sports fandom, right? Wherein the true fans, right, try to sort of mark their territory and keep others out, to keep a sort of closed social circle. And this mode of gatekeeping often breaks down along lines that are not good. So, you know, various feminist sports scholars have written about how male sports fans often construct these boundaries and issue sort of knowledge tests or other means of quizzing female fans who seek to be part of their fan community. And that these tests are not so much really about the knowledge that that the woman in question might have, but about clearly conveying to her that she is not welcome, right? So that's part of the reason that I want to think about fandom on a fluid spectrum, right? That any kind of fan, if they connect their personal identity, the story of themselves, to a sporting event, in that moment they are a fan. Whether or not this is something that is lasting for them, whether or not it's passed down from their father and grandfather, they still have a sort of right to claim a fan identity and are worth thinking about on the terms of fandom.
Yeah, the outline of your book is kind of, you know, each chapter it stands alone in some ways, but they're all kind of interconnected. So I guess I'd like to work through them. You know, one at a time, or talk about them one at a time, and we can continue to speak about this idea of fan narratives and multiple fan narratives. The first chapter, I think, really for people who want to get a sense of what the whole structure of the book is in terms of understanding this idea of multiple narratives, the first chapter really opens that up. And this is the chapter where you're, it's called here, I have the page, the contents page open. So we fabricate baseball in the unfriendly confines of history. And you're looking at Don DeLillo and Robert Kruger's writing about, well, really they're writing about baseball. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you were doing in this chapter.
Yeah, if I could just provide some brief backstory on why the book is structured the way it is.
Yeah, please.
So yeah, I mean, like a lot of, dissertations, I guess, there was a sort of need, I felt a need to demonstrate that I could do fan-related work on narrative in sort of a lot of different places. And so one of the things that I tried to do in the book was to sort of smooth things out to help emphasize the connection between these different chunks, and new chapters were constructed as well. But the first chapter is really one of the first pieces of writing that I worked on in embarking on this project years ago. And so it's the most, probably chapters one and two are the most sort of conventionally literary critical, right? They're based on texts that most, well, at least especially in chapter one, people would understand as fiction, but also really the texts in chapter two are probably mostly understood as fiction. And so the question of how the analysis of these fictional writings can apply to how we understand real sports fans is something that some people might have a question about. As the book progresses, we get to texts that are more clearly about sort of the sports world as we know it. They're about memoirs. There are films, and then finally, the fifth chapter is about sports blogosphere of the sort of early aughts. So it widens out in terms of media types and in terms of the sort of sports universe that is being considered in the later chapters. But these first two chapters are sort of more closely tied to texts that are sort of self-evidently creative in orientation. But I think that they still work, that is still meaningful for the reader, especially chapter one, because part of the point of chapter one, right, in considering DeLillo and Coover, is to think about fandom in terms of that idea of fandom as fantasy and fandom as fanaticism, and how that relates to the sort of real happenings that are taking place on the field, right? The history, if you will. So we fabricate baseball in the unfriendly confines of history, talks about this tension between the imaginings of the fans, the personal worlds that these fans create for themselves and thinking about their relationship to the sport, and the ostensibly real, recorded in the annals of history, the events that are happening on the field, right? And how the fan connects those two things is sort of the point of the chapter. So DeLillo's novel in particular is obsessed with this idea of historicity, right? He documents in the sort of prologue to his massive novel Underworld, Bobby Thompson's shot heard round the world. The shot heard round the world is a title that's applied to a lot of different events in history, but here it's speaking specifically about that famous home run that for the New York Giants against the Brooklyn Dodgers that propelled the Giants to the pennant in, I think it was 1951. It was the beginning of the era of television, so it was documented on TV and radio and, of course, in newspapers. DeLillo picks up on those accounts and weaves them into his account. But he also creates fictional fans, people who we have no idea if people like this were at the event, but DeLillo imagines them. And through those fictional fans, two fans in particular, Cotter Martin, a young African-American kid, who sort of jumps the turnstiles to get into the stadium, and Bill Watterson, an older white man who sits next to Cotter. He imagines the sort of camaraderie that builds between them, but also their inner thoughts, especially for Cotter, right? To his thoughts about how he's connected to this event, what it means for a black kid to be sitting next to this white man at this tremendous event. They're both rooting for the Giants, so they have that in common, but he feels the separation from him. And so it's a really interesting way of using the power of fiction, the power of a novel, to examine the fan psyche in a way that history on its own could never do, right? It could never sort of penetrate the consciousness of the people there in the way that DeLillo's imaginings can. So that's part of that first chapter. And the other part is Robert Coover's novel, which is more concerned with fantasy worlds than actual real baseball. But I think the two texts have a distinct interplay that I think is valuable. So that's sort of the setup for that chapter.
Yeah, both really illuminate the kind of opportunity, emotional ego opportunities and dangers that can come along with different types of fandom. I mean, Martin feeling, at home in this audience, a young black boy, all white audience, and then feeling displaced by the presence of the peanut salesman, who's the only other black person in the crowd. Mm-hmm. So again and again, your work reiterates the kind, it, at least especially in this chapter, I would say reiterates the kind of possibilities of different fandoms and the way in which fandoms can allow you to kind of circumvent life circumstances, as you put it, to escape grand narratives. I wonder if you can talk. I'm an historian by training, so of course I'm like, oh man, escaping grand narratives. This speaks a lot to my own research actually as well. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how fandoms allowed people in DeLillo's story in particular to escape these kind of grand narratives.
Yeah, I mean, I think the character of Russ Hodges is really interesting in this regard, because he sort of seems to realize, Russ Hodges was, of course, a real person, the play-by-play announcer for the New York Giants. DeLillo's imagining of him is based on DeLillo's imagination, not necessarily based on Russ Hodges' sort of actual thoughts or feelings at that moment. But DeLillo's Russ Hodges in this moment of the shot, clearing the wall, the Giants winning the pennant, sort of recognizes the sort of historic importance of what has transpired, that this is history being written. And he tries to market for his partner, the sort of broadcast producer, as they walk out onto the field after the event. As I think he compares it to, where Lee surrendered to Grant or something like that. Like he's saying this event is crystallized here within history, and tries to mark it distinctly as such. And that importance of that event is also, however, overshadowed within the context of the story by the presence of J. Edgar Hoover and his knowledge of a Soviet nuclear test that had taken place the same day, right? And this is part of DeLillo's inspiration for the entire story is that the front page of the New York Times the day after Bobby Thompson's shot was sort of split in half, half about the home run and half about this nuclear test in Russia. So we have these two pillars of history, if you will, that sort of dominate the headlines the next day. But DeLillo resolutely does not allow those significant historical events to efface or dominate the narrative that he tells. He's really focused on these ordinary moments. We talked about Cotter Martin and Bill Watterson, but he's also, he sort of flits around the stands at various points, imagining just for a moment the consciousness of some of the people present, noticing some of the details, some of the things that they're worried about, sort of ordinary things for their ordinary lives. And he really seems to want to emphasize that those things are not to be ignored, that they are not, they should not be erased from how we understand the significance of this time period and these events, right? We shouldn't allow the Lee surrenders to Grant moment to override or overwhelm the powers and the possibilities of individual fans' consciousnesses in these moments. And that's so meaningful to me too, because I think too often with sports, especially, we allow the prevailing story of who won the game and who lost it, who scored the most points, right? Who the MVP was. You know, we allow those master narratives, if you will, to override some of the smaller details that happen in any given event, or that any given fan notices in any event. And part of my larger argument throughout the book, right, is that it doesn't have to be that way. We can read a sporting event for different things. We don't have to premise how we read the sporting event on the tale of competitive dominance. And I think DeLillo's attention to those small things, to those small possibilities of each fan's sort of interpretation is what makes the text a really interesting one to look at in terms of sport and narrative.
And I guess to think a little bit about chapter two, and in your description of them, they sounds like they went together a little bit. And chapter two, for those listening, is "It was my fate, my destiny, my end to be a fan, football, mental illness, and the autobiographical novel." Chapter two also kind of deals with this sense of other alternative narratives beyond this kind of commercial success, right? Or this competitive success. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit what you're doing in that chapter, where you're looking at Frederick Exley and Matthew Quick's work. Whether those works are fictional or not, you'll have to tell me. or you can unpick that knot for us. But what are you up to in that chapter?
Yeah, well, Exley's A Fan's Notes is one of the first texts that I read that I felt like I could write about in a sort of literary critical setting. It's a really ugly book in a lot of ways. These two books are both about football fandom, so the part of the transition here is also from baseball to football. But Exley's football fandom is marked by a lot of the sort of things that you might stereotype a sort of crazy football fan to have. It's marked by misogyny, by homophobia, by a certain violence, by alcohol. So he doesn't paint a pretty picture of himself as a football fan. And the question as to whether this is fiction or not, right, that you broached is kind of the existential question of the text itself, right? Like, who is Frederick Exley? Is there an essential me, or am I just this sort of fabrication of myself, right? That's part of the question of the text, and Exley, the author, and sort of protagonist, if you can call it that, narrator of the text, he blurs that line intentionally. Because the other piece of this, and the framing device really, as you can tell from the second piece of that subheader, is mental illness. Exley himself, the historical person such as we know him, did suffer from mental illness and was institutionalized on several occasions. And his character, the sort of representation of himself in this autobiographical novel, is also struggles with that. So the question of whether sports are real or not, whether they tie us to a sort of historically grounded happening, or whether they are just about our perceptions is an open one for him, because in part because he doesn't really know if what he's perceiving is ultimately real. So that text, along with Matthew Quick's book, The Silver Linings Playbook, which a lot of people might be familiar with from the film context, and I actually talk about the film later in my book, but that film is based on a novel that Matthew Quick wrote. Unlike Exley, Matthew Quick does not insert his own name or lead you to believe that the narrator called Pat Peoples in the book, Pat Solitano in the film, is himself. But actually, in several interviews that he did about the book, he talks about his own struggles with mental illness and his own Eagles football fandom. So there's reason to believe that a lot of his own experiences is also in that text, which also deals with a institutionalized football fan, also a fan of the Philadelphia Eagles, oddly enough. I've got it backwards. If Exley is not a fan of the Philadelphia Eagles, he's a fan of the Giants, New York Giants. Right. But the Eagles are prominently featured in that text because the football player that he attaches himself to, that he sort of considers his like lodestar, his green light, if you will, is Frank Gifford. And Gifford's career traumatically ends, or actually I think he kind of came back briefly, but he was never the same after a brutal hit by Chuck Bednarik, who is a Eagles linebacker. So sorry for that confusion. But the two texts are pretty close in their sort of what football fandoms they're attached to as NFC East rivals. So they're connected in that way. But they're also connected in this question of their own psyches and what sports fandom can do for them in relationship to their mental illness. And ultimately, while both texts feature their fair share of ugliness, I already sort of talked about it in the Exleian context, the character Pat Peoples also has several violent incidents. His father is abusive and alcoholic, so there's that piece of it as well. But in both cases, both for Exley and Peoples, though the texts don't suggest that fandom heals these men or makes them complete or whole or in any way, it does suggest that it ties them to a community that gives them a sort of stable identity in the face of this erasure of self struggle with, right? Part of being institutionalized, part of what both men struggle with is that the institutions in trying to help them with their mental illness wipe away their distinctiveness. They don't feel like they have any identity anymore. And so tying themselves to these particular teams and connecting themselves to the more positive community-based aspects of their fandoms give them identity and ground them in a reality that they can hold on to and gives them some hope. So part of the point of that text is that whereas the first chapter is about blurring the line between fan experience and sort of the annals of history, this is about sort of using fandom to ground yourself on something real, something historic, maybe to stabilize. So it almost works back to history, where the first chapter sort of pulls you away from it a little bit.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Both of these chapters, and I guess in some ways also your fourth chapter on film, deal with, as you suggested earlier, accounts that are fictional or understood to be perhaps in fictional in a more complicated way. So I'm wondering if you can, if I could push at that a little bit to ask you how then these fictional accounts can help us understand kind of lived fandom, in the real world sense.
Yeah. I mean, part of, sort of my baseline argument about, narrative, and I guess I probably didn't articulate this earlier, right, is that if we're thinking about sports on narrative terms, they're not that much different than thinking about novels or films, any kind of story-based entertainment. And oftentimes those story-based entertainments, while fictional, right, provide meaning that helps people in their ordinary lives, whether that be an attachment to Spider-Man or Game of Thrones or I'm not sure what, but cultural texts that don't pertain to our world as we know it, right, can give us things to hold on to for our identity, that whether that be just a community of people to talk to or a sort of inspiration for a mode of behavior, they contribute to our ordinary lives all the time. They help us cohere around a sense of ourselves. These are the things that I like. I pull them into the constellation of me. This is who I am based on the things that I like. Now, obviously this is also grounded in capitalism. So the question of, you know, is our sense of self fundamentally just a collection of consumer products is a fair and open one. But for the purposes of your question about fiction, right, I don't think that there's really any difference in thinking about sports fandom and what it means through the lens of these texts that are overtly fictional than there is through a memoir or through a blog post about real fan experience. Because I think all of these authors, any author who's trying to depict fandom responsibly or in a sort of interesting way, is going to do so in a way that is true, at least on some level, to the mode of investment that we all partake in considering fandom. So I guess I'm not, since I'm sort of destabilizing the reality of any kind of fandom, I think that doesn't really, I'm not really interested in policing the boundaries between texts that are based on real life experience and those that sort of imagine fandom. I'm not sure if that responds.
No, totally. And one of the things you iterate again and again in your book is that the literature on fandom already does this in a lot of ways, but it doesn't do it for sports, right?
Yeah.
Like, for some reason, sports fandom just is considered to be very different than other types of fandom. And your work says, okay, that distinction doesn't make sense to me. And I think very productively it explodes that difference. Although I for our listeners, I guess I wonder if you could explain why you think that that distance and that difference exists. Why have other fan studies not even looked at sports at all, or not taken sports seriously and sports fandom seriously?
Yeah, that's the sort of gap in the literature piece that I try to address in the introduction to my text, right? Which is that there is a large, well-established field of scholarship with prominent scholars that studies fandoms, mostly media fandoms, through a humanistic lens in communications departments, but also in English departments. People study fandom through the lens of visual art, you know, comics and other fandoms. Film studies departments have fan studies scholars. So there's lots of humanistic consideration of fandom and its importance in our culture, but it hasn't much touched on sports fandom as being part of this realm. Where sports fans are studied in the university seems to be in psychology departments, business schools. More quantitative modes of analysis are generally used to study sports fans, whereas there's a lot more qualitative analysis of media fans. There's also quantitative analysis of media fans, so they kind of spread both. But the sports fans don't really come to the humanities side, or aren't studied in the humanities side nearly as often. So that's, you know, that's part of how I position my book, as trying to fill that gap. The reasons for that have to do with this sense of reality with regard to sports, liveness, right? Humanities scholars tend to want a text or a sort of something concrete that they can hold on to and not want to conduct, you know, interviews or survey data or that kind of thing. So that's part of it. It's connected to that liveness piece of it. I think it's also connected to the stereotype, well-founded stereotype of toxic masculinity that's connected to sports fandom, right? This idea that sports fans are mostly men misbehaving and as such, they aren't necessarily very interesting for study from a humanistic lens, that much of what they don't really produce creative texts of their own. They don't really create a culture.
They're kind of passive receivers in a way.
Right. This is very much part of this idea that these men just sort of uncritically consume sports. They're just handed it by culture producers, you know, TV networks and others. And that's all that they do in watching sports. Right. And that's very much not the case. There are plenty of texts and plenty of iterations of sports fandom that defy that stereotype. But it's easy to sort of just dismiss sports fandom for that reason, I think. And, you know, I also think it has something to do with the role of sports in universities, right? I mean, sports in American universities are this massive, at Division I programs under the NCAA system, right? Are this massive moneymaker for the university. They're super prominent on campus. They have an outsized influence on a lot of different aspects of the university. And I think a lot of academics, for good reason, oftentimes, resent that piece of culture that dominates a lot of the campus life and are not as motivated to try and see the things in fan culture that I sort of argue are worth looking at, worth studying, worth thinking about, right? So those, I think, are the main factors for why sports fandom has not really been studied through a humanistic lens. And again, I don't, there is a reason those stereotypes exist. There certainly are pervasive forms of sort of hegemonic toxic masculinity that persist with regard to sports fandom. But I also think there are lots of other ways to perform and engage in sports fandom that are worth thinking about. And I think if we just ignore that because we find sports sort of distasteful, that we're really missing something.
Well, certainly your third chapter illustrates both the vibrancy of the productive vibrancy of sports fans, but also potentially some of those toxic masculinities that you say are there. And so your third chapter is Race in the Basketball Memoir: Fan Identity, the Eros of a Black Man's Game, and you look at a number of different authors: Spike Lee, Scott Rabb, Bill Simmons, David Shield, John Weidman. So what are you doing in this chapter? And maybe, I guess, more specifically, how do you look at these memoirs and illuminate different kind of racialized fandoms within basketball?
Yeah, so this chapter is probably my favorite in the book. I guess I'm not supposed to have favorites, but it was
my favorite in the book until I got to the fifth chapter. But I really liked this chapter as well.
Yeah, I really like this chapter because the first chapter was football, the second chapter baseball, the third chapter basketball. It wasn't really intended to break down on a sport by sport basis, but it's sort of happened that way. And I found years and years ago, I had read Bill Simmons' Book of Basketball, and I had been really bothered by the way that he thought about his own basketball fandom in a book that's ostensibly about sort of ranking basketball players for his pyramid of greatness, or however he wants to reconstitute the Basketball Hall of Fame. And I really noticed, especially in sort of reading this depiction of himself, how clearly racialized it was and how clearly eroticized he made black bodies out to be. There are moments in that text where he talks about, you know, David Robinson's body as he objectifies it as like a Ferrari Testarossa or like a thoroughbred horse. He talks about Manute Bol as having skin so purple he looked like an alien. I mean, it's just really sort of limited and just terrible ways of thinking about these black athletic performers that he purports to have such an attachment to. But beyond just that sort of gross revulsion at that, I began to realize as I encountered other texts, right, that basketball, because it is the American game of the Big Four sports league, right, that in which the demographics are the most African-American. I think it's something like 70, upper 70s%. I'm not sure what the current statistics are, but it is still the case that it is a largely black league with a mostly white audience, that there's a real opportunity here to dig deeper into the racial dynamics of sports fandom and how white fans think about the black athletes that are performing for them. And so I found, in addition to Simmons' texts, I found, I decided to focus on rather Scott Robb's unfortunately titled book, The Whore of Akron, which is about his distaste for LeBron James after LeBron left Cleveland to go to Miami, but before the return to Cleveland, obviously. There's that text, David Shields's book about being a Sonics fan in the 90s, Black Planet, which is a sort of self-flagellating take of his perspective as a white fan of this mostly black team. And he, of the three white authors that I consider, thinks most sort of basically most overtly about his sexual attraction to the players, right? But then I thought it can't just be about, you know, how these white fans exotify black bodies and sexualize them, right, in consuming them. I also, you know, need to think about African-American authors. And I had read John Edgar Wideman's book, Hoop Roots, and then was made aware of that Spike Lee, who of course I knew as a director of many, many films, had also written a memoir about being a fan. And once I brought those texts to the fore, the comparison really opened up, because I was able to see the way in which those African-American authors really recognized this dynamic of white fandom's relationship to black bodies. And even in spite of that, found in basketball a mode, a possibility for not only for black athletes, but also for black fans to find through basketball a means of expression through which they could find resistance to white hegemony and also feel some sense of sort of freedom and of agency for themselves. So that was important to me. And one of the reasons that I really like the chapter is it's not just about how problematic the racial politics of fandom can be, especially when we have a white audience and black performers, but also about how even within that construct, there's room for resistance, there's room for joy and expressivity and freedom. And Wideman and Lee really pick up on that. And to lesser or sort of differing degrees between the two of them. I mean, Lee is himself, because he is such a celebrity force, himself a sort of black performer whose persona is consumed by others. So he has that take on it as well. But I think I've given the main gist of the chapter. When I dig into all their different texts, it can be quite a lot to balance at times, but I think I come out the other side of it with a fascinating account of racial politics and the league that, you know, now has this perception as being the most woke league with regard to social justice issues and things like that. And I think that it certainly has changed and improved in some ways since, say, the 90s when David Shields was thinking about it, but it's still a league that has to grapple with this basic dynamic of who's consuming it and what the racial politics are involved are.
Yeah, I certainly, I thought this chapter was just incredible, and certainly people who are fans of the NBA should read it. Coming from Cleveland myself, I was, I was reading it and I was, it was at times I had to check my own fandom, but, one of the things that I saw in this chapter that kind of underpins a lot of your discussion in the book, but I think comes most to the fore in this particular chapter, is that there's always underneath your discussions of these various types of fandoms, another spectral fandom, which is this kind of commercial sports fandom, a kind of monolithic passive sports fandom that maybe people assume that all sports fans are. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that in relation to this chapter, because certainly we see Rab and Simmons and Shields. They're not ordinary fans, right? So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about maybe how Lee and Weidman and Rab and all of these different authors, how their particular places within the sports world might make them be able to be different types of fans, or can we all be these types of fans and we just don't know it, or how do other fans fit in? You know,
that's an interesting point. I mean, they are all of them, all of the memoirists, privileged in some regard with respect to their relationship to the game. And by that, I mean, you know, Simmons, by the time he wrote the book, had become a popular media personality for ESPN.com. Rab, while he maybe wasn't that well known to very many basketball players, had been writing for, I think it was Esquire, for some time. So he was used to sort of interviewing celebrities and was able to get access to the Cleveland Cavaliers locker room as a member of the press for much of the writing of the book. David Shields was then and still is a professor of creative writing at the University of Washington. And in the beginning of his memoir, the sort of beginning of his time following that Sonics team, he does have press credentials. He eventually gets kicked out for asking questions that are too probing, I guess. So most of the text he's actually only watching from the stands, but he does have, you know, certain privileges and access there. I already talked about Spike Lee. You know, obviously his celebrity plays a large role in how he understands sports fandom. His famous run-ins with Reggie Miller sideline during the 90s in the playoffs are part of the narrative of the book. And Weidman, though not really a fan of the NBA, himself played high-level college basketball at the University of Pennsylvania, and so has a relationship to the game that's premised on being a competitive player with, you know, some of the best college players. So as to their sort of ordinariness, you might say that they all are somewhat exceptional in how they relate to the game. But I think part of the realization that they have, or some of them have, I guess, in the text, I'm thinking most about Weidman and Shields, actually. But the realization that they have is that they kind of have to give up or shed that personality or that status that they previously had to engage with the game in a new way. For Shields, that comes from that alienation from the locker room, that lack of excess, that sort of self-flagellation that I talked about earlier. He comes to understand fandom on religious terms to a certain degree, which is something a lot of people, you know, analogize fandom to religion. But he thinks of it more in a sort of self-aggrandizing way that his sports fandom, like a lot of people's relationship to a religion, makes them feel special, or that they are, you know, cared for in a special way by some higher power. For Weidman, it's about giving up his ability to play. He's sort of forced into fandom. He has this sort of disgust for fandom as a sort of mode of being that is inherently lesser than the experience of playing the game. He's a longtime pickup hoops player, playground hoops player, and he's just aged too much. He can no longer even play on the playground. And so part of his sort of humbling, if you will, is his realization that he can't enter that space as a participant. So, you know, is basketball gone? Is he stripped of this thing that had been so meaningful for him since he's a child? And he ultimately comes to realize that it will be different, but it is not gone. Even humbled, physically humbled as he is, basketball still has meaning and importance for him. So I think, to sort of roundabout way to answer your question, no, I don't think, you know, we need special status or special abilities to come around to sports fandom in a distinct way. But I do think it might be necessary for ordinary fans to have a sort of awakening moment where they kind of realize that just because they live in a market doesn't mean they have to root for the local team, or just because they you know, communed with their father in this way about fandom, or their mother in this way about fandom, that they are trapped into that mode of being, that actually, you know, all fans have a lot of agency in their fandom. You know, it's obvious on one level, of course, you can pick whoever you want to root for, but for so many fans, it feels like a burden. I mean, Cleveland, for Rob, it's like he connects being a Cleveland sports fan to his Jewishness, right? It's so fundamental, core to his identity. He could no more give up his Cleveland fandom than he could give up his sort of sense of identity as a Jew. So yeah, while it may be obvious that you can switch teams anytime you want, I think a lot of fans kind of need an awakening that they can practice fandom in different ways. They're not stuck doing it the way they've always done it. And so you can get more out of fandom, or something different out of fandom than what you have always done to that point.
Yeah. I hate to do this, but I want to skip right to chapter 5, because that speaks mm-hmm. directly to what you're talking about in chapter five, which is reimagined communities, web mediated fandom, and new narrative possibilities for sport. I mean, that's exactly what you're talking about, where fans create their own communities, disaggregated from this idea of kind of geographic filial links that typically define very much who we are. I mean, I'm also from Cleveland, so I've read Scott Raab's work, and I often explain my own personality and identity in terms of Cleveland fandom. You know, don't worry, I'm used to being disappointed. You know. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your fifth chapter and how the internet empowers new varieties of fandoms.
Yeah, the fifth chapter, at the time I started working on it, various aspects of it, it was, you know, there probably 2012 or 13. So this era that I write about, of the sort of mid-aughts sports blogosphere, to me still felt relatively fresh, but now, another 7 years or so after that, it sort of feels like ancient history when it comes to the internet. I talk about three blogs: the Free Darko, which was a basketball blog; Fire Joe Morgan, which was a baseball blog; and a blog by Jessica Luther, who's a sports journalist now. She's one of the co-hosts of the excellent feminist sports podcast Burn It All Down. At that time, she was sort of doing a feminist blog on her own. So I read about those three blogs, all of which ended by 2013 or 14 at the latest. But I think part of what you're specifically alluding to is Free Darko and their concept. This was a collective, several authors, their concept of liberated fandom, which was the first time I read it, just reading their blog for pleasure, was like a light bulb moment for me, right? And it is just what the name implies and what you've been alluding to, right? This idea that you can liberate your fandom from those conventional ways of understanding, and that you can root for a player on a team that you don't even like, just root for just the player, that you can think about storylines that have nothing to do with the competitive construct of the game, that you can care about the aesthetics of a game, that you can think about the sonic landscape of a game, that you can connect that game to, you know, some particular jazz music that you're really into, and sort of compare the stylings of a player to that music, right? That you can build from sports fandom a lot of creative possibilities that don't even occur to a lot of people. And these this collection of authors, who all turned out to be graduate students, as it turned out, really explored those possibilities in new and exciting ways. They sort of thought of themselves as a kind of like basketball avant-garde, right? With any avant-garde, there are always missteps. There are always things that are proclaimed, you know, that turn out to be just, you know, nothing more than a hill of beans. But some of the things some of the concepts, some of the ways of thinking about fandom that they sort of fired back and forth at each other were really influential for me, and I thought were really fascinating. And foremost among those was liberated fandom. Another thing that they talked about, though, that's relevant to today's NBA was what they called the positional revolution. And the positional revolution was a way of thinking about players as not tied to our conventional ideas of what those the positions that they play are supposed to do, right? And so they imagined, you know, centers who would shoot threes all the time, and point guards who would be sort of rangy individuals who, you know, could lead the team in rebounds, and thinking beyond the sort of basic constructs of positionality with regard to basketball. And that seems to have be what has happened to basketball some, you know, a decade later.
Right?
If your center doesn't shoot threes, you have a problem because the other team is going to stretch you, you know, try to pull your center out of the paint, even if he doesn't want to come out. So, so the blog turned out to be very influential, in some ways. And it was also a really fun read because they took a lot of joy in the sort of their creative expression as basketball fans, themselves.
This chapter really made me think of two things. One, this kind of, especially in the Free Darko, emphasis on style, really sounds like sports in some ways from the 19th century, where, you know, they'd have races, you know, track and field style races, where the winner of the race could be the person not who ran the fastest, but who ran in the most stylish way, in the most correct way. So it wasn't enough to just be quick. You actually had to also be to be physically stylish. And so that was kind of interesting to me. But one of the reasons why I liked this chapter the most when I finished your book, and maybe I shouldn't play favorites either, but one of the reasons I thought it was the most interesting is each one of these blogs in some ways, because they applied a critical reading to sports, in fact, changed the sports that they were reading critically. Mm-hmm. You know, so whether it's Free Darko or Free Joe Morgan or Power Forward, they all kind of changed the ways in which people think about or view the sports. I wonder if you can talk about the possibilities for new critical fandoms to just change the way in which sports are even played.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a way in which you can see the influence of these blogs in our contemporary sportscape, even though most people have never heard of any of them. I already sort of talked about Free Darko's influence. Fire Joe Morgan, which was authored by a collection of comedy writers who sort of did this as their in their free time. One of whom is Mike Schur, the showrunner behind The Good Place and Parks and Recreation and other shows, who also does a baseball podcast with Joe Posnanski these days, I think. Anyway, this group of comedy writers were very invested in thinking about baseball in smart ways using analytics. And at the time that they were writing in the early aughts, a lot of mainline baseball journalists were very resistant to analytics as ways of thinking about baseball strategy. And Joe Morgan, the person that they encouraged to be fired, was particularly vocal about this, suggesting that, you know, baseball scouts could use their gut to determine who a good baseball player was. They didn't need to use any measurables to do so, right? And instead of laying out the math really for people, instead of sort of trying to show how important analytics could be by showing just how effective predictors of excellence they really were, this group of comedy writers did what comedy writers do, which is make fun of the journalists. It was really a satire site, someplace that was supposed to make you laugh at the idiocy of these various journalists. It wasn't just Joe Morgan. It was many, many journalists, and not just TV journalists, print journalists as well. And that's part of what I think was so interesting about the site, was that, you know, certainly analytics have taken off, and every professional team has an analytics department. And there are all kinds of ethical questions about, you know, measurables with regard to biometrics and all of these things that teams are doing to try to have the most information about what's happening on the court at all times. But while they, you know, thought that having that information was important and sort of wanted to preach the gospel of you know, new and better ways to measure the game of baseball, they would not put aside the fun of it, right? They would not leave aside the sort of the humor and the laughs, right? They're comedy writers. They understood the importance of joy in all of that. And I think you can see that influence in a lot of spaces on the internet that there's a lot of places where, you know, smart takes on sports are appreciated, but there's also humor involved. Whether that be, I don't know, I'm trying to think of, the, you know, the, even just your basic Twitter thread often turns into a kind of joke fest in certain places. It can also turn into other things that are maybe less, sure, less hilarious. But there's a, I think, sort of the wacky sports world, the making sports fun, focusing on that fun is something that, you know, baseball is desperately trying to do this. Their whole thing about let the kids play, right? They're trying to energize their fan base. They're trying to make the sport fun for people again, right? And that's something that I think Fire Joe Morgan did really well. We can be smart about baseball while we're still having fun with it. That isn't to say they didn't take on serious issues as well. They also talked about, you know, the race in baseball with regard to players like David Eckstein, the scrappy lunch pail players who just so happened were always white. Mm-hmm. You know, they did engage with serious issues as well. But I think the most important thing that they did was emphasize that you can be a smart fan while still having fun being a fan. And then as for Jessica Luther, like I already mentioned her involvement with current involvement with the Burn It All Down podcast. She's written a lot. She has an incredible book that I recommend everyone should read called Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and the Politics of Rape, where she talks about the prevalence of rape on college campuses more broadly, and then how it specifically relates to athletics. And then even within that, how the sort of racialized portrait of Black athletes committing these sexual assaults is then sold to the public. It's an excellent text, critical look at that, but she laid the groundwork for a lot of these critical issues on her blog. A lot of the things that she's become known for sort of set up in that space. But she also took time to really be a fan. It wasn't just a place of professional writing. She also talked about her personal connection to Serena Williams, her fandom for Brittany Griner. So it was very much also a fan space.
This chapter really made me think, as well as chapter 3, about whether there was a possibility for a kind of critical fandom that created better spaces for non-white, non-gender binary, non-heteronormative, female athletes. Is this a kind of possibility for a more critical fandom, or and is this something we should all be doing as our sports fandoms? Like, what can we do to help create these spaces, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that those spaces increasingly exist. The Burn It All Down podcast and the community around it is one of those spaces. It's a resolutely feminist space that forefronts female voices always, and wants to give you know, women's perspective on these sporting issues, both with regard to the athletes themselves, with regard to women athletes, but also just with regard to women fans, so even if they're fans of men's sports. So that's one of those spaces. I mean, I think the internet, it can be so ugly, and it can be easy to vilify it as a place where sort of people's worst impulses are given a forum. But I think it's also a place where, you know, there's suddenly space for these smaller groups or these groups with specific interests that need empowerment, that need encouragement, to find each other, to find support, to find community, right? And at its best, sports can be a really positive space of community formation. So where sports and the internet allow these kind of new formations of sports fans from disadvantaged groups or from, you know, from people with perspectives on fandom that are committed to anti-racism, committed to, you know, fighting homophobia, committed to these issues, that, you know, the internet provides a platform for that to happen. So part of the message of my fifth chapter too is, right, is that yes, Barstool exists, ugly sports fandom is out there on the internet. That is a problem, but we can't just blow up the internet because there's also a lot of good that's happening there with regard to sports fandom.
Well, I want to encourage people to go out and pick your book up and read it. I especially loved, as I mentioned, the third and fifth chapters. I think fans of contemporary sports, especially if you're an NBA fan, need to read these chapters. The final question with us is always the same, which is, Now that we've enjoyed this book, what can we look forward to next, Noah?
You know, I'm only in the very earliest stages of the next project. It's really something that I'm still brainstorming, but I'm really interested in thinking about the football helmet on multiple registers, and thinking about the football helmet as a site of traumatic violence and brain trauma. Obviously, this is in the headlines a lot, but also as a cultural and aesthetic object, right? And what it signifies for how we think about this mode of masculinity that is forged in American football. So while I haven't written any sort of words beyond my own sort of scribbled notes to myself on this, that is the project that I'm sort of dreaming about these days.
Well, that sounds interesting, and I'm hopeful we'll talk about it when it's a completed project. We've been joined here today by Noah Cohen, the author of We Average Unbeautiful Watchers, Fan Narratives in the Reading of American Sports. It's out from University of Nebraska Press in 2019. You've been listening to the New Books in Sports podcast, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone, coming to you live from Macquarie University. Thank you very much, Noah, for joining us.
Thanks, Keith.
Thank you all for listening.